Well, let's get on the baseball front right now because we got a Hall of Famer sitting here waiting to chat with us. And Jim Cott, I can tell you this. It's a long time ago when he came to the Phillies, and I remember doing the first interview with him when I was working with the Phillies when he came in. And I'll tell you, it was a great delight the period of time they were. Jim, welcome to the show, and thank you very, very much for joining us. And I also want to say at the top, I want to thank Billy Wendell because I know you were on with him last week, and Billy and I worked together for about 40 years. And he said, Jim Cott would be a great, great guest for you. So I thank Billy for setting it all up for us. Jim, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, Billy put me in touch with my good friend Bill White on the phone for a while last week, which was always nice to talk with Bill, who is 90 years old now. But, yeah, happy to be on with you.
Well, I'll tell you, Bill and I converse once in a while. And before he moved from his home into where he's living today, I'll tell you, Bill is a terrific, terrific guy, and very disappointed that he didn't also get into the Hall of Fame with you. He missed it by one vote, and Bill White is one of the class people of all of baseball. But let's get to some of your career because it was fantastic. I mean, just the number of games that you won, 283 games won, 2,461 strikeouts. But what I want to talk to start the program off with, I want to talk about pitching. And go back to 1960 when you and John Sane got together. Johnny Sane, of course, part of the Atlanta Braves and Milwaukee Braves, spawned at Sane and Pray for Rain. He was one of the great pitchers. He became a pitching coach. And you met up with him in 1960 when he was pitching coach and you were there. And you said your goal when you started the season was to pitch 40 games, to pitch 280 innings, and to pitch every 4 days. That was your goal. And you and Johnny Sane worked on it. And so tell me about this. This is not the game we're looking at today.
No, that was you. Of course, John, when he pitched with Warren Spahn back in the 40s, and, you know, the game wasn't based on power and young kids chasing velocity then. It was pitching. Pitching was more of an art form than a science experiment where everybody tried to see how hard they could throw and how hard they could maintain it. But so John, you know, reinvented himself in the late 40s, right after World War II, and then became a coach. And gosh, he was so special to me. But he was kind of a believer in it'll rust out before it'll wear out. So he had us throwing the ball every day. And I remember he told Ralph Houk when he went to coach for the Yankees, he said, "Who's your best pitcher?" And of course he said, "Whitey Ford." Well, at the time, Whitey was winning like 16 games a year. And John said, "Well, if he's your best pitcher, wouldn't you want him out there every 4 days, like 40 times a year? Because certainly pitchers are capable of doing that. The arm will recover in about 72 hours. So on that fourth day, you're ready to go again." And lo and behold, Whitey goes 25-4 the next day. So, you know, that's where John built his reputation. And everywhere he went was with Mudcat Grant and Mickey Lolich, McLean, Wilbur Wood in Chicago. He was a great believer in throwing the baseball as often as you could, which I think, you know, made you feel comfortable on the mound, that your control was good. You just much better than pitching every 5 or 6 days. And if there's a spot in the Hall of Fame for pitching coaches, I think Johnny would be the number one choice.
Well, you tried it for a while too as a pitching coach, but also you and John got together twice. He reinvented you the second time as well when he speeded up your delivery. Of course, your delivery was always pretty quick, but he changed a little bit there, which you said gave you a second life, and you won a lot of games after that.
Yeah, that's what John brought to the table. You know, he wasn't a method guy, but he would look at you and say, "Well, you know, if I were in your shoes, what would I want to do to improve?" And when the Twins put me on waivers, I was coming off a year where I broke my wrist in 1972, sliding into base. So 73, I was pretty spotty. And they put me on waivers, and I was so fortunate that Roland Heeman, general manager of the White Sox, and along with Chuck Tanner and Johnny Sane, said, "Well, let's get him over here." And so John looked at me, and he said, "Well, we have to speed up your release. Your arm's just a little bit lazy." And so I just kept getting faster and faster, and finally I said, "Okay, I've just fielded a ground ball. and I'm going to throw it home like it's a 1-2-3 double play. And that's where the quick windup came about, you know. And I was, my record early in 74 was 4-6. And we came off a road trip. We were at O'Hare Airport getting our luggage. And Chuck said, come in and see me a little early tomorrow, Chuck Tanner. Well, my first thought was that, you know, because Harry Carey was calling for my scalp, he couldn't understand why they kept running me out there. And
you were just one of many. You were one of many.
Right. So Harry's great line was, if your fastball and your slow curve are the same speed, it's time to call it a career. So I go in and see Chuck, and the first thing he says, he slaps me on the shoulder. You know, he's one of the most positive guys you'll ever be around. And he said, look, you've
Absolutely.
Been having 15 wins a year for 15 years. I think you can still do it. You're going to start a week from Monday against Cleveland. Go down the bullpen every day with Johnny and see what you can figure out. And that's where that quick pitch came from. And I ended up that year 21-13. And without, I would say, just about any other manager I played for other than Chuck Tanner would have probably advised the front office to release me. But Chuck was, he loved his veterans, and he was, he believed in me. And, you know, I owe him so much, like I do Jack McKeon, who was that kind of manager for me in the minor leagues, playing manager.
Trader Jack.
Oh, yeah. He was 27, and I was 19. And now Jack is 93, still living in North Carolina, doing some scouting. But he had a great influence on my career in 1958.
Yeah, he's in Burlington, North Carolina, and my son lives there as well, and he goes to the gym with her every morning. He's a big guy for working out. But let's get to Roger Hendler. He's in Atlanta right now, and moved out of Philadelphia, moved to Atlanta. You're on with Jim Cobb, Roger.
Oh, I know. What an honor. Jim, you know, I'm looking at the statistics in your career, and it just reminds me of that great period when you were with the Phillies. 76-79, Steve Carlton, Mike Schmidt, Greg Luzinski. We thought that maybe get to the World Series during that period. That had to be exciting. But one of the things that really, and Don and I talk about this all the time, and it's just the going deep into games anymore. It doesn't happen. And they just had a statistic out today, which I would challenge. It was about the war, you know, with pitchers. And they said that this, now that the team of Nolan Wheeler has the best war of any tandem, and Steve Carlton never had anybody to work with. And I'm thinking when I read this, wait a minute, Jim Cott was there during the peak period of the Phillies with Steve Carlton. What about that twosome? But, you know, it wasn't brought up. And here you're a Hall of Famer. I don't get it.
Well, of course, Jim Lonborg was a big part of our pitching rotation. And the Phillies didn't get the best of me. You know, I was an every 3-day, every 4-day pitcher. And Danny, he kind of liked to spot start guys. You know, Danny Ozark, nice guy. But I really think if Whitey Herzog had been managing those teams, Whitey was just so sharp in maneuvering his bullpen, because those were physical ability. Those were the best teams that I was ever on. Those teams in the late 60s with the guys that you mentioned. But you mentioned war, and I speak out about this all the time. War is one of the phoniest, deceiving stats that there is, because there's so many ways you can shoot holes in it. We could do a whole program by it. I think there's even general managers that don't, first of all, they don't understand all of it, and they don't really abide by it, you know. But the people that are behind the scenes that have never played and don't know the game, they have a little acronym that they can latch onto and make it sound like they're smart, and that's war.
Well, I think that's very interesting, because now Aaron Boone, you know, they completely redid, Cashman and Boone redid their team of experts, supposedly, because they weren't effective last year and they couldn't transmit the information to the players and the managers and so forth. And now they got a guy from MIT that's going to sit on the bench next to Boone and give him all this information. I just don't understand how I mean, these guys have played baseball all their lives. And a guy sitting in it from MIT is going to tell you what to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, if they I do a podcast tomorrow, and we're going to talk about that. But I say if you took all the money that they invested in analytics departments, and, I mean, teams are pouring millions into it.
Right.
You just hired some former players that had big league experience and paid them big money. Right now, if you said to Greg Maddux, we'll pay you $10 million a year. You come out of Las Vegas and you coach our pitchers. Well, I'll guarantee you those pitchers would learn a lot about pitching from Greg Maddux. But, you know, they don't pay coaches a lot of money, and they're putting all their faith now in the science instead of – there was an article the other day that said basically those of us that have previous experience, we really don't have a place in the game. And I can tell you that the things I learned from Warren Spahn and Whitey Ford and Robin Roberts, guys who were all Hall of Famers, and picking their brain, I mean, without them, I don't know what my career would have been like. But those are the guys I wanted to lean on, guys that had done it and were successful doing it.
Roger?
Well, I was thinking about Harvey Haddix and the 13 perfect game. And, nobody today, they're lucky if they can do that. Six innings. You know, and bring on the bullpen. And it just amazes me. I'm so used to growing up with you and the Robin Roberts, Kurt Simmons, the pitchers when I was a kid. And not necessarily a kid, but in my school years. And,
right.
And it just annoys me to see the way the pitching staffs are ruined or not really handled properly, I guess is the right term today.
Well, they're all hung up on this third time through the batting order, and it's really not
yeah.
the pitcher's fault. It's the system. And even Max Scherzer spoke out the other day, and this goes back to what the commissioner had told us at our Hall of Fame meeting last summer. He said, what we really miss is the marquee starting pitcher matchup. Like I remember doing a game in Philly 10, 12 years ago, and it was Pedro Martinez against Tim Lincecum, and they both went, I think Pedro might have gone the distance. Maybe Brad Lidge saved it, but, I mean, the starters were there almost to the end. But now even Scherzer says he wishes that, you know, they would allow us to go deeper in the game, but they have the geniuses that think that the third time through the batting order that you know, the numbers say you can't let them do that. I said to Sandy Koufax, because he beat us in Game 7, 1965, and we had a couple men on in the fifth inning. We were starting to make some noise. I said, man, if analytics were around then, they might have taken him out in the fifth inning. what a bonus.
Well, that was quite a series, because you guys won the first two games, and then it went
yeah.
seven, and you finally lost in the seventh
game.
Yeah,
we ran into, you know, Koufax and Driver. They just didn't give us – we didn't score much off them after that.
I loved your comment when you said you warmed up right next to Koufax before the game, and you were listening to the ball banging into the catcher's glove.
Yeah.
And you said, I don't think everybody's ever going to hit this guy.
yeah, he was something special.
Well, I'll tell you, let's go to one other thing, because the Phillies had – and. Roger, I think, would allude to it as well. Timmy, my great friend Timmy, lived right pretty close to us here in Sarasota, and he was on the show quite often. And Steve Carlton and Timmy just had that great rapport. Was there any catcher, Jim, that you really had a great rapport with outside of the pitching coaches that you worked with and then the talented managers that you worked with? Was there a catcher that you really said, man, this guy knows what I want to do?
Well, I think I was fortunate. I said in my Hall of Fame speech, I had 38 different catchers. Actually, Timmy was one of them. Timmy caught me a couple times in spring training, but never much during the season. But he was such a bright catcher. And I had Earl Batty early in my career. And Earl was this laid-back, mellow, easygoing guy. And for me as a young pitcher, that was really important. You know, he kept my emotions, helped me keep my emotions under control. And then later as a veteran, I ended up pitching a lot to Phil Roof, who was still in the Twins organization as kind of a catching advisor. But Phil was one of those guys that we just kind of clicked when you look down and you're thinking, I think it's a good time for a fastball, and you see number one or vice versa, and you're on the same page. And that's really what the chemistry is between pitcher and catcher, and Phil was one of those that was very good for me.
Roger.
Yeah, I know. Roy Halladay said that Carlos Ruiz was the best catcher he ever worked with. And, unfortunately, it wasn't for as long a period as everyone had hoped. But, and obviously he was, when they won the World Series in 08, and they had success in 09 losing to the Yankees. But I wanted to ask you, going back to the Twins, I remember that 65 World Series, and it was interesting. I was doing a show up in Princeton a number of years ago, and we had Don Drysdale on, and he was alluding to that series and the Twins. And I found it very, very interesting coming from the Dodgers' perspective, and now getting to talk to you and your perspective about it. But, that was just a wonderful time of baseball, a wonderful period, and just great teams. But, you were such a great fielding pitcher, Jim. And, everybody knew that. And, now, at least pitchers don't have to worry about that anymore. How do you feel about that? Because, you've been a great broadcaster, so you can express your opinion about anything.
Well, I'm very outspoken about it. I know the commissioner said to me, he a lot of the front office people in used to be Park Avenue, the office is on 6th Avenue now, but they don't like the analytics any more than most of us that are, kind of like the traditions that the game had, bunt, hit and run, steal, things like that. But he said organizations claim that, this analytics stuff helps them win two or three more games a year. And I'm thinking, well, how stupid is that? Because if they all have the same information. So if this team wins, there's another team that's losing.
Right.
And then I said, the next time a general manager says that analytics are helping them win an extra three games a year, you tell them that by not teaching their pitchers how to field their position, it's costing them about six games a year because they're never in position to field the ball. They're getting hit in the back. They're getting hit all over the place. And they don't even in spring training stress the fundamentals like we did. I mean, we did those things over and over, and it would get a little boring after a while, but it paid off because that's where you build your foundation for being able to execute the fundamentals, and teams don't put that kind of time into it anymore.
Jimmy, before we run out of time, just a couple of things about your broadcasting career. First of all, you retired and became a pitching coach. Then you were with the Yankees at the end and wound up in the booth. Was Bobby Mercer with you in the booth up there? Where he hadn't passed away at that time, but was he with you in the
Bobby
booth? I can't remember.
Bobby and I, we worked quite a few games together.
That's
that
what I thought.
That was the biggest break I got, really. Tony Kubek, who had retired, and I knew Tony when I was doing Twins games, and he did some Toronto games years ago and then Yankee games, and he was always very complimentary to me. And so when he decided to retire, he suggested to the Madison Square Garden Network that they hire me. So that's really led me into getting the Yankee job, which I did for 13 years. And what a great 13 years it was, because that's when, Derek came up in 95. And they had good teams right through, I think they won again in like 2008 or so, and then things went the other way. But, boy, those were great teams to follow, those Yankees in the late 90s.
I've never met anybody that retired from as many things as you have. I listened to you when you were retiring from baseball. Well, I'm going to take up a radio career now. 13 years later, you sat in the booth, I can remember, and they were so complimentary to you and always talked about, why is this man not in the Hall of Fame? But 13 years later, I'm going to retire and play golf, going to go to Huizinga's place down there and hit some golf balls every day. Next thing you know, you and Bob Costas are on MLB. I said, this guy's retired from more places than the President of the United States.
Well, I never really retired. They always ask me when I retired. I never retired as a player. They just decided to let me go. And then just with the announcing, I actually walked away from the Yankee job in 2007 because my late wife was battling cancer and subsequently passed away in 2008. And then the MLB Network launched in 2009.
Right.
And Tony Petitti called me and said, would you like to do some games again? And I didn't want to do a lot of games, but it worked out. So Bob and I for 14 years did like 10 to 15 games a year, which was really enjoyable.
Roger?
Do you see yourself getting back and doing some games on TV, on MLB or, Yankees, Phillies or any? I'll tell you, last year the Braves had former players and all former players, Jeff Francoeur, Smoltz, Glavin and Chipper. Okay.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned Greg Maddux, but he's in Vegas, like you said. It was fascinating. I mean, it just was, they didn't have anybody, just the four of them. And, and Glavin is definitely serious. He was not cracking many smiles because he's really into the game. And Chipper was having a ball, but they all did. It was fascinating. And I would love to see that with more of just you and players just talking about the game, and especially like with yourself with all the broadcast experience you've had.
Well, the best 6 years, and I liked all the guys I worked with. I worked with, good training from Dick Enberg and Dick Stockton, a little bit from John Madden. But when Kenny Singleton and I did Yankee games, just two former players, and we could switch off the play-by-play, it was just two guys talking baseball. And those were the best years. But really what caused me to leave the booth a couple years ago is that it's become so data-driven. They got all the numbers on TV, and you hardly have any time to really talk about what's going on in the field because they have all these percentages and then they're all sponsored. The StatCast might be one of the worst things to come into the game. It's altered so many the way players play and the way teams operate. And I just said, I don't want to use the booth as a platform to talk about how stupid I think some of the things are that they're doing, because that's not your job in the booth. You want to make it enjoyable for people. And I said, I can't do that anymore because the game is not enjoyable to me anymore, so I just walked away.
Well, that's almost parallel to what the last time I talked to Bill White, which was maybe 2 months ago, month and a half ago or so, and he said that exactly what you're saying. I can't watch baseball anymore.
No, he doesn't watch anymore either, I know. Well, that's true. And, I'm glad there are fans that like the game the way it is today. That's fine if they like power and the strikeouts, but that's not the game that I fell in love with as a kid and that I like to follow. So I'm not going to change the game, but I don't have to be a part of it. I still follow it. I still do a little ambassador work for the Twins, and I don't have anything to do with the baseball ops because like the modern people said, those of you with previous experience really have no voice anymore because we have artificial information that is a lot better than what you guys can offer, so we stay out of the way.
Well, that was really interesting.
Gambling.
We had Larry Bowe on with us 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I said to Larry, if you're managing today and you got your pitching staff all lined up, and how would you go about it? He said, I can't. They wouldn't let me. So
right.
He said, he said, there's no sense even talking about it because it's past history. They have somebody there that's going to tell you what to do every minute, and you're not really running the club. Although I won't say that. I won't say that for the manager of the Texas Rangers. He runs this club, and analytics is not a top shelf item with him.
Right. Yeah.
Which is refreshing. I mean, that Bruce Bochy has taken that position. The other thing that annoys Don Frank and me is all these gambling statistics. And like you said, Jim, sponsored. Okay. Oh, yeah. Tonight's over-under sponsored by such and such. It never ends, and I'll just turn the sound down and won't even listen to it. And I do the same thing with the NFL. I'll watch it. I could care less about the broadcasting when they're doing it this way. I want to do it like you said that you when you grew up with it, and we're traditionalists. That's baseball, and that's the way I want to watch it.
Jimmy, before we run out of time, you also made the transition. Of course, you had gone to college and worked a little bit on journalism, but you wrote a marvelous book, and I want to give you a chance. Of course, it's a year or so old now, but give you a chance to talk a little bit about it, because there are a lot of people that still would like to get it and have a chance to read it and get some of the information from you through the book knowledge as well. The name, and where can people get it today?
Yeah, I think it's out of publication now. I mean, they could get it like on Amazon or eBay, but it's really about my eight decades in baseball. I broke down, I didn't play for 80 years, but my career touched starting in the 50s and then right into 2022. Bob Costas was adamant about it. He wanted me to work into the 2020s with him because he said then your career would cover eight decades. I think maybe Vin Scully and maybe Uke now. I don't think Uke started till the 60s, but so it's a little bit about, you know, what went on in each decade and then how the game has changed and the things I like about it and the things I don't like about it. You know, I mean, most of them are the things I don't like. What I like is that the players today are the most talented group of players that I've seen. They're so athletic and talented, and I just wish that they would just let them play instead of making robots out of them.
Roger.
Because we would see a top quality of baseball.
Jim, we talked about this many times on the show, and I go to a lot of high school games in the area that I live, and I'm friends with the parents of a number of players, so it's like become a real family. But the one thing that we always talk about is the arms of pitchers wearing out. Because when they're young, yes, they're limited on what they can do in Little League. They're limited what they can do in Babe Ruth. And they're limited in high school. But the problem is when they are playing in two leagues, there's not that much control. And I really think, we think, that has definitely had an effect on all these pitchers having to get Tommy John surgery before they're 22 years old.
Oh, there's no question. I have a good friend who's a physical therapist in New Jersey, and he's got right now double-digit teenagers who have had the Tommy John surgery or are rehabbing. But, you know, the problem is they think that pitch counts and inning restrictions will solve the problem. That's not it. They have to, somewhere along the line, MLB has to invest a lot of money into getting coaches to teach kids how to throw properly and kind of put a governor on them. For example, Lucas Giolito, if you followed that story, now looks like he may have season-ending surgery. And the Red Sox had him all built up. He was going to be their innings eater because they thought he could get 180 innings out of him. Well, Lucas Giolito was first clocked at 90 miles an hour when he was 14. And then he had Tommy John surgery when he was 18. I mean, that's another accident waiting to happen. So we got to do something with our youth to be able to, you know, to not throw 90 miles an hour if you're capable. Let's just pitch at about 80 and don't worry about the number of pitches. Let's worry about the number of strikes and the number of outs and get back to, you know, the way the game should be played. And that's where it has to start. We're going to continue to have those injuries. And Dr. Andrews, who's retired now, but he said the same thing, this travel ball and all these leagues.
Jim, we only have 1 minute to go,
okay.
I think you had a little bit of an advantage because you were so small in high school.
Right.
Well, you were.
That's right.
You got big, you know, when you were first year in college and so forth. So you didn't throw that hard. How hard did you throw when you first came up?
We had no idea. We didn't count pitches, and we didn't clock pitches. We just counted outs.
That's the way
Jim,
it should
be. Hall of Famer Jim, I want to thank you so very, very much for being on with us tonight. I hope we do it again. You're a little bit more in-depth with your book and some of the other things that you think are positive and negative about baseball as we look at it today. And once again, my thanks to Billy Wernendael and to Bill White. Bill White's 3 months older than I am, so
yeah.
I don't get to the 90 mark until June the 18th. So he's way ahead of me.
Well, you're doing well. That's good,
Jim.
Thank you so much,
Ray. Okay,
we'll get together again soon.
All right, guys.
Take care.
Take care.